This morning we're going to begin our series in the book of Genesis, beginning in Genesis chapter 1. And so I want to invite you to turn there, Genesis chapter 1. If you didn't bring a Bible, it's in the pew in front of you, you'll find it on page number 1. Just in case you're wondering where that is. Last week was our re-engage weekend, which was really an invitation for you to join us and become engaged in community, to become part of what's happening around here in a community group, in one of our classes. We've got a number of classes again, or in one of our serving teams. And, you know, there's all kinds of options. Whatever stage you're at, wherever you're at, there's an option that's like, fits for you. And if you're wondering like what that is, you just go back to that welcome new here area and they'll help you. But if you're like, I just don't really know where to plug in, let me encourage you to join a community group that is just studying through the sermon series that we're working on. Because in this series that we're working on, there's going to be a lot of things to talk about. Genesis 1 to 3 touches on all kinds of things that are sort of relevant, obviously always relevant, but hot topics today. Things like, who is God? What is he like? But then we're going to talk about faith and science and evolution. We're going to talk about what does it mean to be human? What does it look like to live as a human? We're going to talk about how do you find rest in the middle of the craziness of this life? Is it possible to find rest? Then we're going to talk about all kinds of issues, things like gender and marriage and work and the environment, and what does it mean to be a Christian and engage with those kinds of things, those issues. And then we're going to talk about living with temptation and how to deal with sin and evil and curses and what God is doing about all these things. And so there's going to be a lot of fascinating things that we cover over this series this fall in the opening three chapters of Genesis. Now, you can come, and I hope you come regularly and listen as we open the Word together. But there's something about sitting around with a group of friends and opening the Bible and discussing it yourself and saying, here's what it says, and what does this mean for how I live and how I interact with my neighbors and my friends and my family. And so I just want to encourage you, if you're not in a group and you don't know where to get involved, join a community group. It's a great place to start. Now, the series itself we're calling Blueprint, because that's in fact what Genesis 1 and 2 are. They're really God's blueprint for how this world is meant to run, how we're meant to live in the midst of it. And blueprints are important. You know, again, that we're in the middle of this building campaign. We are in the process of refinishing or raising money to refinish the outside of our building. And now that they've cut down all the trees on Lougheed, by the way, we didn't do that. People say, why, you cut down the trees? No, that wasn't us, it's the province, because they're widening the highway. But now, you know, when you drive by, you see again, God has given us a beautiful building, but it needs some TLC, right? And so we've been raising these funds. We're raising $1.3 million. We're already at $750,000 or more in that process. And so we're excited for what's going on there and what's happening. It's just good stewardship. You've seen we've got an architectural drawing for, you know, this is what it's going to look like. So we got that. I went to the building committee. I said, okay, guys. I mean, these guys, they know building stuff. I'm like, let's do this. We got a drawing. Let's get the construction guys in here. Let's do this. And they're like, wait, you can't just give a guy a hammer and say, start working on the building. Because the problem is the first guy will build one thing, the second guy another thing, the second guy another thing, and you'll end up with chaos. What you need is a set of blueprints that guides how it all fits together, what it looks like. And in fact, if you're wondering where we're at in the process, that's exactly where we are right now. We've got the architectural drawing, but now the engineers and the consultants, they're drawing up the blueprints so that when they build it, everybody knows what it's going to do. It's all going to work out the way that it should be. So the latest that I've heard from the building committee, and these guys know tons, is hopefully by spring of next year, we'll actually invite the construction guys with their hammers to come and work on it. But right now, we're still in that process. So I wanted to update you. I wanted to thank you again for your generous giving. If you're not part of that campaign, we want to invite you to join us. And you can find out more online or their little card in your pew. But the point is blueprints are important. Blueprints help everyone understand this is how it should be. This is what it should look like. This is how it all works together. And that's what Genesis 1 and 2 are about. And then Genesis 3 is all about what happens when we crumple up the blueprints, throw them in the garbage, and everyone decides they're going to figure it out on their own. And the result of that, of course, is chaos. And we'll talk about that, and then, of course, what God has to say about that. But today, as Katie read, we're going to start in Genesis chapter 1. And we're going to look at what it says. Now, the book of Genesis was written by Moses. And you have to know that Moses was not some backwater hick who crawled out of a cave and decided to write down a little bit about what he thought was going on. Moses was a man who was adopted into the household of Pharaoh. I mean, Moses was raised at the very heart of the greatest empire of the ancient world. He knew all about power and wealth and amazing, you know, things. His grandfather, Pharaoh, was literally worshipped as a god. So Moses comes from this very sophisticated background, and yet when he looks at everything, he's like, yes, but there's more than this. And God reveals to him, and this is how he begins the book of Genesis. Genesis 1:1 begins this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So Moses, who had seen it all, pyramids and palaces and great cities and massive armies, Moses says, look, all of this stuff that we see, that we have, it comes from somewhere, from something, and that somewhere, that something actually happens to be God. He says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, when we hear that, the first question that should come to our mind is, what's the first? The first question is this, who is this God? Who is God? But what is the natural question that comes to our mind? The one that we always sort of focus on so much when we come to Genesis chapter 1 is, how? How did God create the heavens and the earth, right? I mean, we've spent all kinds of time talking about, like, how did this happen? Was it God? Was it like 6 literal days? Was it millions of years? What about the dinosaurs? Where's the, you know, what about the galaxies that are expanding? The question that we always start with is how? And frankly, how is a good question. I mean, how is where a lot of the debate in our culture is today? How did this whole thing come to be? And so, in fact, we want to talk about how next week. We're going to talk about all that kind of stuff, faith and science and evolution and how it happened. But you have to understand that when Moses began to write this opening chapter of the book of Genesis, how was not his primary question. The primary question that Moses wants to answer in Genesis chapter 1 is not how, but who. Who is this God that created the heavens and earth? Who did it? J.I. Packer, the well-known theologian and writer, says this. Genesis 1 and 2 tell us who, without giving many answers about how. Some today may think this is a defect, but in the long perspective of history, our present-day scientific preoccupation with how rather than who looks very odd in itself. Rather than criticize these chapters for not feeding our secular interests, we should take them as a needed rebuke for our perverse passion for knowing nature without regard for what matters most, namely, knowing nature's creator. The message of these chapters is this. You've seen the sea, the sky, sun, moon, and stars. You've watched the birds and the fish. You've observed the landscape, the vegetation, the animals, the insects, all the big things and little things together. You've marveled at the wonderful complexity of human beings with all their powers and skills and the deep feelings of fascination, attraction, and affection that men and women arouse in each other. Fantastic, isn't it? We'll now meet the one who's behind it all. As if to say, now, since you were thrilled by the music, we will introduce you to the composer. It was to show us the creator rather than the creation and to teach us knowledge of God rather than physical science that Genesis 1 and 2, along with such celebrated passages as Psalm 104 and Job 38 and 41 were written. So, today we want to talk about who. The question that we want to answer, that Moses primarily wants us to answer, is this, who is the designer? Who put it all together? And what is he like? And what does it mean for me if that's who he is? And the simple and the unequivocal answer that Moses gives us, like three words in, is this. The designer is God. That's who. Now, to stand up in our culture today and say, God created the heavens and the earth, You know, again, a lot of people say, I don't know about that. And there's lots of debate around that. And again, we'll touch on some of that next week. But the question is this. If God created heaven and the earth, what's he like? And secondly, where did he come from? And the second one, let's start with this question. Where did God come from? Because today, you know, if you talk to those who are hardcore atheists, I mean, one of the challenges that they have with their worldview that, you know, all started with a Big Bang is this, well, where did the Big Bang come from? Now, Richard Dawkins, a well-known atheist, has said, well, okay, we got an issue there because we don't really know. The question is, where is God come from? I mean, if God created everything, who created God? That's his question, right? And in fact, it seems like this is a good question. I mean, yeah, but what's the deal? The problem, though, happens to be with the question itself. The question assumes space and time, right? It assumes that there was a time that God began and that he began within space. And the problem is that that's not the case at all. You see, we live in a world that is so bound by space and time that we can hardly conceive of a world outside of space and time. I mean, your commute tomorrow, when you go to work or to school or wherever you go, it's all about space, how far you've got to get, and time, how long it's going to get there, right? And you can hardly conceive a world that doesn't involve that. In fact, even in our family where we dream about and hope for the day when they create the ability to teleport, you know, beam me up, Scotty, like, and reappear because we're always late for everything. Even when we talk about that, it's still about space moving from here to here over time. And maybe it's not an hour, maybe it's just a second, but we can't get away from this concept of space and time. But see, what Genesis teaches us, what Moses says here at the beginning is this, that it all began, that the world began. So there was a point in time when there was no time, if you can imagine that. And God existed outside of space and outside of time. In fact, it was he who created that, right? I mean, the first day he created light, but it was the first day. It was the beginning of time and the beginning of space. So here's the deal. God exists outside of space of time. And we sometimes say, well, I can't wrap my head around that. Maybe, but the fact of the matter is it still doesn't change the fact that it's true. I mean, a fish in the sea so surrounded by water can't comprehend the idea that there's a car. I mean, the fish has never been outside of the water, no legs, no arms. Doesn't change the fact that there's a car, right? So here's the deal. You can't ask who created God because God always existed. He exists both within and outside of time and both within and outside of space. God simply is. So that's the first question, or the second question, rather. The first question is then, okay, if this God who's always existed created us and this place, what is he like? And to that question, Moses goes to right away. Fourth word of the Bible. In the beginning, God says, created the heavens and the earth. Now, the word created there is a Hebrew word. Moses had two options when he chose what word to use. One was the Hebrew word asa, which means to make or to manufacture, to take stuff and to manufacture something out of it. But rather, what Moses uses is a different Hebrew word, the word bara. And bara is used 48 times in the Old Testament and only and ever in relationship to God himself. No one else in the Old Testament baras. And we translate that as created. But what the word bara in Hebrew means is to bring order out of chaos. It's all about organizing and bringing meaning and purpose to things. So the word bara means to bring focus where there was no focus. It means to take a thing that was a mess and to give it, you know, direction and organization. And it also has this meaning about assigning roles and functions to something that didn't have a role or function before. So, listen, that means that when Moses said God created the heavens and the earth, it's more than just kind of plop, 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 here you go. It's like, no, he takes out of chaos and he begins to organize it and to give it function, to assign it function and roles. And here's what happens when you assign something a function and a role. You give it value and purpose. And this is the first thing that we understand about who God is. He assigns purpose and value to each part of his creation. Now, this is important for us and how we see the world. You see, again, if you come from a background or if you come hold a worldview that says, you know, we just come from a big bang, sort of this fluke of nature, just bang, here it is, and evolution has brought us all the way to this place. The challenge that you have with that mindset is that there is no real meaning or value to your life. Not in the big picture. I mean, in the big picture, you're just part of this evolutionary machine that's just grinding away with no particular direction, no particular purpose. Let's go till, I suppose, the sun burns out. I mean, who knows where? But if you understand that there is a God who created the world and brings order out of chaos and gives meaning and purpose and value, that means that you have meaning and value and purpose in your life. Not just humanity, but in the billions and billions of people who live on this planet. And of the however many billions who've lived throughout history, your life today here in Maple Ridge has purpose and value and meaning because God created the heavens and the earth. He's assigned it value and purpose. So Moses begins right out of the bat saying this is who God is. And then he begins to explain how God brings order out of chaos. And so let's read the first five verses again. It says this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And of course, as Katie read throughout the passage, God just step by step says, and then it does, and it appears. And so on the second day, he creates the expanse between the skies, right? The sky and the waters below. On the third day, he puts the waters in the seas, and the land appears. And on the fourth day, he sets the sun and the moon and the stars in their places. And on the fifth day, he creates the creatures of the sea and the birds of the air. And then on the sixth day, he creates the animals of the land. And then he creates us, humanity. And as you watch, you see this progression from chaos to greater and greater order. And this, again, is what Moses wants us to see, and that's this. The designer, God himself, created this world out of chaos, and he's creating it for his glory and for our flourishing. That's why he created, for his glory and for our flourishing. So let's talk again here. Let's start with the second idea. He created this world for our flourishing. Now, when you read what Moses says about creation, it's like a countdown. It's like the old countdown reels in the old movies, you know? Most of us are probably old enough to remember when they put the film in the projector, you know, and it goes, right? And then it's 10, 9, 8, counts down to the movie starts. Well, that's what's happening here. It's counting down. Creation, as God creates it, moves together toward a point, towards a something. And that something happens to be us, happens to be humanity. And so that's what God does. He begins by creating everything necessary to sustain life. He brings light and water and sky and sea and land and plants. And the way that he designs it to sustain life is remarkable. In fact, it is incredibly fine-tuned. And Moses, of course, he's talking about God. So he's just like, here's what he did. Here's what he did. But scientists are going deep. And they say that the way that this planet, this universe has been created is incredibly fine-tuned. In fact, they call it the Goldilocks effect. You know the story of Goldilocks, right? I mean, she went to the home of the three bears. She tried the porridge of one. It was too cold. The other one was too hot. But this one was just right. And that's what scientists say about the planet that we live on, the universe that we're in. It is perfect for life. In fact, it is so finely tuned that if one of any multiple different variables was off by just a fraction, the ability for us to sustain life, for life to exist, would cease to exist. Hugh Ross, a scientist and astronomer, writes this. The number of details fine-tuned to favor life's possible existence argues powerfully on its own for the existence and intervention of a divine creator. Even if the universe contained as many as 100 billion trillion planets, probabilities would argue against the existence of even one that by natural processes alone would end up with the just right surface gravity, surface temperature, atmospheric composition, atmospheric pressure, crustal iron abundance, tectonics, volcanism, rotation rate decline, stable rotation axis, and degree of tilt for the benefit of advanced life. In other words, it is so finely tuned on so many different levels that if any one of those were out, there would be no way that life could exist. And if that was like too scientific, like for your mind, and some maybe some for mine, then it was explained this way by another astrophysicist from the University of Chicago. He says this, his name Michael Turner, he says, the precision of the universe is as if one could throw a dart across the entire universe and hit a bullseye 1 millimeter in diameter on the other side. I don't know if you've ever tried to throw a dart across a room. I mean, this is impossible, right? But that's the point. Outside of a creator who specifically and intentionally designed it for life with us in mind, it couldn't have possibly happened. So that's what God does on the first 4 days. He prepares it for life. Then on the fifth day, he creates the animals. First, the tiny little creatures, things like plankton in the sea, bugs in the air, the kind of thing that Moses refers to as all the swarming creatures. But then he also creates the bigger animals. And these ones, he uses a Hebrew word, the word nephesh. Now, nephesh is a Hebrew word that has a number of meanings, but it can mean, and in this case, it means soulish. In other words, he creates animals that have a sense of understanding, a choice, a will, that show emotions and have passions. And when God, when Moses comes to this part of creation, he uses these two Hebrew words again to describe what God does. He uses the word asa, in other words, to make out of what exists. But then for only the second time in the first chapter of Genesis, he uses the word bara, meaning that he again created. And there's this sense that what God did is he formed the animals, but he gave them something new, something different. He gave them these soulish features, a will, a mind, emotions, right? I mean, you can see this in your dog. Your dog has a soul. I'm not so sure about a cat, you know? I looked in the eyes of my cat. I wasn't sure there was a soul in there, but you get the idea, right? I mean, this is what he created. God, on the fifth day, raised the level of creation. Now there's a soul. There's emotions involved. But then on the sixth day, then God created, first of all, the livestock, the animals for eating, the wild animals, the final things necessary to sustain life here on the planet for us. And then on the sixth day, God created us. He created human beings. Verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And this here is the third, the last place in the first chapter of Genesis that Moses uses the word bara. And again, just like with the animals, he uses also the word asa. In other words, there's a manufacturing idea out of what already exists. But there's also a sense that now, once again, God is stepping it up. There's something more. And this is the pinnacle of creation. And we know, later in Genesis chapter 2, he says that he formed us out of the dust of the earth. He asad us. He manufactured from what was there. But there's also the sense that he bared us. There was something new. And the new that he put in you and in I, in every human being that has walked on the face of the earth, is that he put in us the image of God. He breathed his spirit into us. And that sets us apart from all of creation. And that puts us in a unique place. And here's what comes with the spirit. I mean, with the spirit that God put in us comes this sense of a self-consciousness, a self-awareness that the rest of creation doesn't have. And we also have a concern about life and about death and a question about what happens after life. And then they also built into us as human beings a need to worship something or someone. I mean, it's a human trait, this need to worship. And he built into us an awareness of right and wrong, a conscience. And he gave us the ability to have language, to be able to communicate in sophisticated ways, both in print and verbally. And he gave us the ability to have abstract thoughts, to think abstract thoughts, and to seek after truth, right? And all these traits are found in every human being throughout all of history because God created us with a spirit. You see, He built this world so that we could flourish in it. He built this world for us. He designed it for us. And then He built us. He designed us for Him. He built us so that we could know Him and that we could worship Him and that we could bring glory to Him. That's how the designer made it. You see, He created this world not only for our flourishing, but for His glory. And indeed, if you ever can find the time, and it's not easy, but if you ever find the time to slow down and to really look at the stars, just to gaze at the stars, or if you stop at the edge of the pounding oceans and just look out at the seas, or if you stand still in the midst of a mighty storm, or if you have the privilege to study the intricacies of the human cell or the vastness of the universe, if you stop long enough in the busyness of your world to really consider it, you can't help but see the hand of God. You can't help but lift your heart to worship someone, something that would make this world such an incredible and such an amazing place. King David, who was a shepherd before he became a king and spent many nights, no doubt, out in the fields looking up at the stars. At one point, he writes this: "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims His handiwork." That's who the designer is. He is a designer who this is God, who placed you and I here so that we could flourish. I mean, He created us so that we could know love and joy and meaning and fulfillment, everything that makes this life rich. But He created us also so that out of that, out of the flourishing of our lives, might flow a glory and a worship and a praise to Him. The problem that we as humanity have is that we really caught the second part of that, the flourishing part, but we missed the glory part. And so our tendency, the human tendency, has always been to leave our eyes from the Creator and to begin to worship the creation, right? Because we have this need in us to worship. We just desire to do that. And this, I mean, this is a human trait. You can see it anywhere that humans are all through history. In Moses' day, for instance. In Moses' day, they created and worshiped all kinds of created things, right? I mean, in Egypt, it was the sun god. It was this god of the moon. In the pagan nations, it was the god of the sea and of the sky and of the stars and the god of the mountains and the rivers and the rain. I mean, they made gods out of all kinds of things that were just creation. And their gods, those gods in their minds, were these sort of limited power gods that had control over a little area of creation. But you had to placate them. You had to manipulate them. You had to keep them happy. Because they were nasty and they were, you know, kind of weak, but they had these outbursts of anger and temper tantrums. And so you spent your life trying to manipulate the gods. Now, we look at that and say, that's ridiculous, right? I mean, there's no God, son, no, we don't do that anymore. The problem we have is we've simply switched from worshiping that part of creation to worshiping ourselves. Right? In our world, we say, well, look, no one believes that, but we've elevated ourselves to be gods. We say, there is no higher creature. There is no one that is above us, so we get to pick how we live. We get to decide what is right and what is wrong. And Moses, aware of this again, wants to reveal to us in the opening chapter of Genesis just who exactly the designer is. And here's what he communicates again out of this opening chapter, and that is this: that God, the designer of the earth, is the unrivaled ruler of creation. And no one is his rival. No one is his equal. And he shows this to us in two ways in this account. First of all, he has this little refrain that he uses over and over. And you can't miss it when you read the passage. It begins over and over. He says, "And God said," and then he says what God said, "Let there be light, let there be land, let there be," God said. And then, after he explains what God said, he says, "And it was so." The designer of all the earth, the creator of all the earth, said, and it was so. God said, and it was so. And what Moses wants us to see and know is this: what God says goes. He is the unrivaled ruler of creation. And then, just in case we miss it, he begins by running through all of the gods that humans make. Sun god, nope, God made the sun. Moon gods, nope, no such thing. God made the moon. You know, sea gods, nope, created by God. Anything that you can imagine, nope, nope, nope. All of it created by God. Humans, nope, created by God, by him alone. And in the process, he wants us to understand that, in fact, we are not gods. Now, we struggle as humans with this. Sometimes our response is simply to ignore them. Nope, I don't believe you there. I have nothing to do with you. And other times, certainly for many of us, we acknowledge that he's there, but we still slip into this habit of trying to manipulate and control him. God, I've been good. I've done all the things you asked me to do. I've been faithful. I've given. I've served. You owe me. Or, God, how dare you? How dare you allow this to happen in my life? God, if you were a good God, you would never do this. How can I trust you if you do this, right? I mean, we know this, don't we? Look, if anyone had the right to question God, it was Job, right? You know the story of Job? Job was a man who did everything right before God. I mean, he was faithful, he served, he sacrificed, he was so careful. And God, the creator of the universe, allowed some really hard things to happen in Job's life. Really hard things. And when they came on his life, you know, his wife said, look, it's so bad, you should just curse God and die. And Job, to his incredible credit, said, no, should we just accept good from God and not bad? And he bows down and he worships God. But the troubles don't go away. The troubles keep going. The troubles continue for a long time. And eventually Job begins to say, God, you owe me an answer. You owe me an explanation. Why is this? And at the end of the book of Job, God says, you want an answer? Okay. And he comes and he meets Job in a whirlwind. And this is what it says. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. And he said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you and you will make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determines its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy. And he goes on chapter after chapter to describe the moments of creation. And he says, Job, were you there? No. No, no, no. You, Job, you've forgotten that I'm the creator and not you. I'm the one who designed this creation and not you. I am in control and not you. And I'm not some petty little God that you can manipulate and throw a temper tantrum and say, well, I'm not going to follow you if you don't do what I say, because that's not who I am. I am the sovereign God of the universe. Now, here's the problem with that. Here's the problem. The question is then, if he's sovereign over all, if he has utter control over everything, what kind of a God is he? Because he's going to have control over it all. Is he going to be a good, a faithful, a beautiful, a wonderful God, or is he going to be a nasty, brutish, short-tempered, narcissistic God? Like, that's the question, isn't it? Because that will have a profound effect on our lives. And here again, Moses wants to help us understand who God is. And again, he uses a little refrain sprinkled all through the first chapter. And he tells us this, that God said, let there be, and there was, and God, and it was so. And then Moses tells us over and over again, he says, and God looked back and said, it was good. It was good. Time and time again, he says it was good. In fact, for all of the days of creation, it's really interesting. For every day of creation, except for one, God steps back and says it is good. The second day of creation, it doesn't say, and it was good. Now, theologians have asked about that and wondered about that, and nobody's quite sure, but I have a theory. You know, the first day of creation was Sunday, right? So the second day of creation was Monday. Which seems to suggest that maybe even God doesn't love Mondays, right? Just a theory. But the rest of it, all throughout, it's like, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, until verse 31, which says this, "And God saw everything that he made, and behold, it was very good." See, here's what Moses is communicating to us again that we shouldn't miss, and that's this. The designer of the universe made the universe very good because he is very good. The character of the designer is reflected in his design. We see the picture of God in his creation. He designed it so well, so beautifully, so intricately, so amazingly. And he did this because he is a good, good God. Now, of course, we still struggle with that sometimes, don't we? We say, well, yeah, but do you know how hard my world has been? Do you see the destruction that's out there? Have you read the news? Do you understand the suffering that's happened in my life? How could he be a good, good God? Well, here's how. Because you see, the God who laid the foundations of the earth, the one who put every star in place and who commands every blade of grass to grow, that God became part of his creation and lived in his creation and then willingly suffered at the hands of his own creation so that he might reconcile us to him. And that's profound if you understand how big, if we begin to grasp how incredible God is. The Apostle Paul explains this in the most profound, mind-blowing way in just a couple of short verses in the beginning of the letter to the Colossians. He's writing about Jesus, and this is what he says. He, Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Paul says this, if you want to see the God who laid the foundations of the earth, the God who said, let there be light, and there was light, if you want to see the God who created each day, the sun, the moon, the furthest galaxies, and the tiniest, most microscopic creatures that live on this earth. If you want to know what he is like, who he is, look at Jesus. Because that's who he is. He is the image of the invisible God. And he is the firstborn over all creation. Now, that doesn't mean that he was the first one created. That's not what it says at all. What Paul is using is the language of his day that referred to the rights of inheritance and the rights of ownership. In other words, Jesus is sovereign over all of his creation. He is the unrivaled ruler of creation. He's over it all. And listen to what Paul says next about Jesus. He's talking about Jesus. For by him, by Jesus, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. You understand what Paul is saying here? Paul is saying this, that Jesus himself was intimately involved in the process of creation. He was there on those days. He was in the midst of it. It was created through him and for him. And it was created for his glory. And then he goes on to say, and he, Jesus, is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Before space and time existed, Jesus existed. And everything, all of creation, exists and is sustained only because of Jesus. Only because he holds it together in himself. If he ceased to hold it together, it would cease to exist in a heartbeat. This is who Jesus is. And then Paul goes on to say this. For in him, in Jesus, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. And through him, to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you who once were alienated, who were so far from this beautiful God of creation, and who were hostile to him in your mind and your heart, and who did things that were utterly opposed to him, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh. He became like one of his own creation by his death in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach. The God of all creation sent his own son, Jesus, to come and die for us so that we might be reconciled to him. Is he a good God? Is he a good God? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he is so good. You can trust him. No matter how hard your situation is, no matter how long you've struggled, no matter the brokenness in your life, you can trust the designer and creator of this world because he is a good, good God. And he has come to know you and to give you meaning and purpose and value in this life and in the life to come. And is he worthy of praise and glory and majesty and all honor? Absolutely. Above all, the unrivaled, unbelievably beautiful ruler of all creation. That's who the designer is. So may we be a people who not only trust him, but who also worship him, both in what we say and what we do here on a Sunday morning, but also in the life that we live as we go from this place. Oh God, we lift our hearts to you today because Jesus did pay it all. Your own Son who was with you at the foundation of creation, who stood with you and was created, creation was created through him and by him and for him. Oh God, he came and hung and died so that we might know you. And so God, today we lift our hearts in gratitude again, in gratefulness that you would call us, that you would give us life through him, through Jesus. And God, we want to worship you with our words, but also God, as we go from here, Lord, in our lives, in our workplaces, among our families and friends and our neighbors and the things that we think and read and do, God, may every part of our life flow out of a love and a worship of the Creator God who sent his own Son. So God, we give ourselves to you again today, and we thank you and we praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. God bless you. Have a great week. We'll see you here next week.